You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey everybody, CJ here, and let me wish you a happy Halloween for 2019. Very happy to be back with you. I've not been cranking out too much lately. I've been continuing to deal with some medical issues, and I know I've said this before, but this time I actually believe it, that I've finally started to get things under control. Basically, the short version without too much details is that for about 5 or 6 weeks, I've been dealing with two different digestive issues, both of which have been causing me off and on two different types of chronic pain. So sometimes I've been having one sort of pain, sometimes another, sometimes both at the same time, and then little gaps where I don't have pain. And sometimes when I felt good for a day or two, I've thought, oh good, I've finally licked this thing and I'm on the mend, and then it would come back and it was just driving me insane. And anyone who's had any sort of chronic pain understands just what this can do to you in terms of your mental health, your psychological state, your energy levels, your patience, your ability to concentrate or not. And then it was intermittent, so the chronic pain would go away for a while, but then I had this sort of Damocles hanging over me, and the whole time I'm wondering if and when it's going to come back. So anyway, this has put a real crimp in my ability to make and produce and crank out DHP episodes. But fingers crossed, after multiple doctor visits and tests and various things, I think I'm finally getting the right combination of food and nutrients and medication and things to get things back on track. So anyway, enough about what I've been suffering through for the past 5-6 weeks. Let's talk about the 2019 DHP Halloween special, which turns out I'm going to break into two parts because it ran so long. So in recent weeks, I've been back in touch, and we hadn't been in touch for a while, with my good internet friend Joshua, who used to run the Dusty Den podcast. Some of you may remember that show. I enjoyed it very much, but it is now no longer, although Joshua is still around. And he'd gotten back in touch with me, and we've been emailing back and forth a bit in recent weeks. And basically, I invited him on for a DHP Halloween special because we're both fans of horror fiction and horror movies. So we had a big, long, rolling conversation addressing each of our top fives and a bunch of honorable mentions in each of the following four categories. So first, top favorite horror films overall. Second, underappreciated or unsung or lesser known favorite horror films. Third, favorite horror novels. And favorite horror short stories. And the conversation ended up running, because of course both of us could talk about these sorts of things all day long given the chance, the conversation ran to Joe Rogan Experience length, so ultimately I decided to cut it in half. And so this episode, episode 189, is going to be the two categories covering horror films, and then episode 190, which I'll probably put out a day or two after this one, but still in time, you know, before Halloween hits, is going to cover favorite horror novels and short stories. So, you know, this is not going to be a typical history narrative type of episode, but I usually do something different for Halloween anyway. So if that's all you listen to the show for, feel free to skip this episode if it's not your bag. But if you're at all interested in the spirit of the season, and or if you are also a fan of horror fiction and film, then you'll probably enjoy this episode. Hopefully you'll get some good suggestions of things to look up and check out that you didn't know about before. And of course, there will be copious links, Amazon links in the show notes to many of the things that we mention. So without further ado, part one of the 2019 DHP Halloween special. Joshua, welcome back onto the Dangerous History Podcast. It has been a very long time, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. It's been a long time. It's great to finally get to talk to you again.
Yeah. We did a fair number of episodes together a couple years ago or whenever that was. And I'm happy to have you back on for what will be my 2019 Dangerous History Podcast Halloween special. I always do something Halloween related this time of year. So I know, like me, you are a fan of horror films and yes. horror fiction, and you know a lot of stuff about that, maybe even more than I do, and I know a lot about that stuff. So I thought it would be really cool to have you on and just talk about some of our favorite horror films and novels and stories and, you know, run through some of our top picks and some of our runners up and all that. And I think this is going to be a really good seasonal conversation. It'll go great with any sort of pumpkin spiced whatever that anyone might want to sip while listening. And hopefully they'll get some good picks. You know, I'm going to try and get this thing out at least several days before Halloween itself. So hopefully the DHP audience will have an opportunity to benefit from our picks and suggestions and so forth. So I'm looking forward to our chat.
Me too. I could have easily done a top 50 in at least two of these categories, but probably all three. And this, I think, I sent an email to you commenting on like how brutal this was. It was really deflating when I started whittling down my list. I was like, oh, I can't get rid of that, you know, but then I would have to. And it was really excruciating would be the word that I would pick to describe what it was like eliminating some of the things that I wanted to include. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And that's part of the fun is coming up with a, you know, top fives or top tens or whatever. We did top five. So,
Yeah. I had asked you, should we do top 10? And you were like, well, then that makes it a heck of a lot of things to run through. It's like, yeah, you're right. And yeah, I mean, same thing for me. It was excruciating whittling it down to a top five in each of these categories. And then even once that was done, having to deal with, you know, ranking the top five. I was moving things often on my list and moving things around inside my list. No joke.
Yeah,
about 15 minutes before I sent you, before I sent you the link to the Zoom meeting, today, I was still moving a couple things around on my list going, I don't know, maybe this goes over here. Yeah.
So. Yeah. I made a last minute change last night. I was getting ready to go to bed and I was like, nope, that one just doesn't belong on the top five. It just doesn't belong. So I eliminated it and then brought another one in that was a runner up. So.
Yeah. And I had a few that, I had it mostly done, I thought, yesterday afternoon. And then, you know, this afternoon, just in the hours beforehand, I was like back into it. And I also had where within just the past few hours, I thought of a few things I had not thought of, you know, a couple. I was like, how did I not think of that movie? You know? So anyway, well, yeah. Before we launch into it, starting with our sort of top favorite horror films overall, I wanted to ask you in general, when we're looking at horror films, whether it's your top favorites or your favorite unsung, underappreciated ones, which we'll also talk about, where do your tastes and preferences tend to run in horror films? Like what kinds of things really work for you in terms of not just subgenres, but like there's so many different approaches to how to make a horror film. There's so many different, you know, there's the more kind of jump scare. There's the more subtle. There's the, you know, lots of blood and gore. There's the more kind of suspense and implied things and, you know, less is more and that sort of thing. So what are some of the things that, like, if you're looking at your own favorite horror movies, even your top 100, that a lot of them seem to have in common that really kind of are your taste?
I would say, and this is not, I don't think a super specific answer, but it's things that make me scared and that, or eerie, like make me like, give me that eerie feeling, hair on the back of my neck, standing up. It's almost like, you know it when you see it or you know it when you read it. I'll tell you what doesn't work for me And I don't necessarily have a problem with it because I don't have a problem with gore at all. Like I, you know, gore is, you know, I love Nightmare on Elm Street films and things like this, but the torture movies, that's a genre with things like Hostel and things like this. That doesn't really work for me. Like I don't get much enjoyment out of watching those. I've seen some of them. And then there are some that are like supernatural movies that are one that I'll just go ahead and say would be on my honorable mentions, which is Suspiria. That's all the reason like something like that wouldn't make my list is because it doesn't have quite enough narrative structure for me. So I do like a story, and that'll go along with one of my number ones. So I won't elaborate on that too much about why it's number one, but I would say just things that combine elements of mystery with, I like twist endings a lot too. Things that really make you think a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like a fair amount of overlap with a lot of my preferences. I'm also not a big fan of the sort of torture porn horror. Me with gore, it's like, I'm not necessarily against it or turned off by it. I do think it's often used as a crutch.
Yes.
And I do think it's often overused. Yeah. And so, you know, my default preference is less is more with that. Not because I'm, you know, clutching my pearls squeamish or whatever, but I just sometimes think that it's lazy and it's a substitute for the things that would make for a better movie, like story and characters and suspense. And I really like suspense of one type or another. And I really like movies that are good at making an ominous mood more than anything else I like horror movies mostly with a few exceptions that build kind of slowly. I actually like slow horror movies when they're done well.
I do too.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like it when a skillful director kind of takes his time and effectively does less is more. And through whatever combination of audio and visual is just able to give you that ominous sense of dread from early on that slowly builds. And so yeah.
a lot of long shots too. I like that in film.
Yeah.
Long shots or things that aren't perfectly visible all the time. I like it when a director or especially a writer, whichever genre we're talking about or whichever medium rather, really can get the most out of your imagination. I think yes. That would be a good way to put it.
Yes.
And there are some directors that are amazing at that and writers for sure that are amazing at that. And they don't really have to spell it out for you, but they give you just enough to keep you wondering, like, and they don't have to explain everything. I think sometimes people want an explanation so bad with everything, and they don't realize maybe part of the reason they like the film or the book so much is because there was some open-ended things, you know, to discover there. Yeah. I wish I had an answer for that. But really, maybe one of the reasons you enjoyed it so much is because you really don't know the answer. So yeah. I like that as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. And I kind of feel in a way similar to just sort of jump scares the way I do about gore, where it's like, it can be effective, but it's easy to just use that as a crutch and it's easy to overdo it. I mean, there are some recent horror movies like that are like the big mainstream ones that like pretty much all they have is either just, you know, simple jump scares and then like big CGI, you know, effects and things like this. I'm thinking about stuff like The Conjuring and, you know, that kind of stuff where I feel like a lot of the movies in the 70s and 80s and even in the 90s, when they didn't have the ability to just lean on CGI, they had to be more clever and creative and more indirect and, you know, rely more on implied things and that sort of stuff.
No, I agree. In fact, a lot of my selections, particularly in film, are probably in that era, which was, I think, the gold, like, I wouldn't say the golden age, but definitely the modern golden age anyway, of, you know, of horror, horror films or suspense films, any way you want to cut it. A lot of my selections, though, are from all over the place, but there does seem to be like a 1990-ish sort of cutoff. I'll have to look at some of the dates to see if there's anything post 1990, but I don't believe there is on my list.
So. I've got a few more recent ones, but the more recent movies that I really like tend to be the ones that are not the big Hollywood productions, that are either indie films, or if they're not indie films, they're at least kind of like, you know, not the really big ones. You know, they're the ones that horror fans will all know, but that the general public, they have no idea. Their idea is like, what? Ouija 2, that's the horror movie genre, you know?
Yeah, I have a couple of those too. So a couple new ones that I think are pretty good, but.
Yeah, yeah. And one more thing, that this is something that I really appreciate in the films and in the novels. In the shorter stories, it's less important. If anyone heard that was a clock falling off my wall in my office for some reason. I'll fix it later. That's random. But that I like films with a lot of realism in everything except for, you know, potentially the horror, if it's supernatural in nature or whatever. In other words, I like the setting and the characters and all that to really be as realistic and real feeling as possible. That way, whatever the horror is, if it is something that is supernatural or fantastic, and it doesn't have to be, it can be, you know, like a realistic serial killer or something. But if the horror is something that's, you know, fantastic, supernatural, it really is extra important that your characters and your setting and all that stuff feels plausible and real. Otherwise, the whole thing just seems unrealistic, and it's hard to be scared of something where everything about it, just from goofy supernatural things happening to the characters being cruddy to, you know, the setting not quite working. I mean, it seems like the more your horror is gonna be abnormal or supernatural, the more important it is for everything else to seem totally plausible and real.
Absolutely. And actually, we can talk more about it later as we get into our lists, but that's a similar point I was going to make with one of my selections, is how, especially with film, when a director can make a place or a group of characters seem so authentic and give them such real problems and personalities, and it almost makes you suspend disbelief more. It's where you're more willing to accept the supernatural or the fantastic, and it integrates nicely, and it makes it more real to you. And I think that's a very psychological truism, that it lets your guards down. You know, it lets your senses that you're watching something that's, you know, made up. It kind of lets you forget that for a minute. You know, there was a great, I was watching an interview, and somebody was talking about the movie Jaws and about how, you know, at the end, when I guess it's Roy Scheider's character shoots the oxygen cylinder that's in Jaws's mouth, and, you know, Jaws explodes into a million pieces. And they're like, you know, that's ridiculous. If you just look at that on the face of it, that's a ridiculous scene. That just, those physics does not behave that way. Like, there's no way you're going to shoot an oxygen cylinder and then it's going to blow up a shark. Like, it just doesn't work like that. But Spielberg has you so invested in the characters and the tension that you totally forgive that. Like, you don't even think that that's unreal when you're watching it. It seems totally plausible for the moment until you examine it, you know, just because the rest of everything works so well. And, you know, you have those gritty, real kind of characters that, and it's paced very well. And I think Jaws is a good example. It's not on my list, but I think it's a really good example of horror done right, you know. So maybe that should be an honorable mention. I didn't write it down to make a note of it, but it's definitely one where I think it shows you how good direction, good writing, good performances can allow you to suspend a lot of disbelief.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. So let's go ahead and get started.
Let's do it.
Counting up our each of our top fives, and we're going to alternate back and forth each number for just favorite overall best, you know, in our opinions, horror films of all time. So just like overall favorites.
All right.
And so how about you go ahead first and give us your number five?
Number five. I have The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the Disney version, which is an animated film, an animated short film.
Interesting pick. I like it very much.
Yeah, it's based on, obviously, the Washington Irving story from 1820. Disney released it, I think, in 1949. And it was originally released with the very brilliant The Wind in the Willows, which is another one of my favorite Disney pieces. And they packaged it together. It was called The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. I picked it because it is the first childhood memory I have of being truly terrified. I had these VHS cassettes, and people who grew up in our era, you know, that's what we watched stuff on, was VHS. And I was lucky enough to have the gold versions. My parents had bought the gold versions of these collection of Disney cartoons. And one of them was called Scary Tales, I think. And it was a bunch of like Halloween themed pieces. The Dancing Skeletons was on there. One called Trick or Treat with Donald Duck was on there. A bunch of my favorites. One with a gorilla.
I think I had that exact same tape.
Maybe you did. I'm pretty sure I did. It was either released in 1977, 1982, or 1983. They released three of the volumes, and one of them was the gold volume. And in the beginning, it told you all about Walt Disney and the creation of the studio and this and that. And it went in a nice sort of biography. And then you get right into the cartoons. And on the gold edition, the Legend of Sleepy Hollow cartoon was at the very end. And it was so scary to me when I was a kid and I would watch it, but I loved it. I think it's just very special to me because not only is it well done and well animated and well told, Bing Crosby does the narration and the voices of Brom Bones and Ichabod, but it was just it being that final segment in a host of cartoons that I loved and grew up with was just sort of like the exclamation point on the season. And I would watch it every Halloween. I would watch it every time. And I still, last year I pulled up on YouTube and me and my kids watched it and they loved it and thought it was great.
That's interesting hearing you describe that. Cause with you saying that, I'm flashing back to having very similar experiences watching the Sleepy Hollow cartoon and all the other stuff you're mentioning. So I really think I had the exact same tape or somebody, you know, I knew had it or something. I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I can remember being very young and watching all those cartoons. And like you said, Sleepy Hollow at the end. And yeah, it is surprisingly scary for what you would think of as just a simple kids cartoon.
Yeah. I think it's because again, it's a bit open-ended. Some of those things that we were already talking about, like you can assume that Brom Bones is behind the Headless Horseman, or you can assume not, you know, and like just the way that it's done with the sound design, the animation, and just the story in general, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, it's just so brilliant. And I know in previous Halloween episode, you covered this. I believe you even read the story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually the short story by Washington Irving is one of my runners up for top short stories. So yeah.
That's my number five pick. It relates to something else I want to talk about later. So hopefully I can circle back to it. And I'll just preload that as saying, to me, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is like, it's a signifier that Halloween and the season is kind of over and you're ready to go into like the early months of winter. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was because it was the last cartoon on the video that I had on the video cassette, but it always had this sort of, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but a degree of finality to it.
It's like a bookending of the season.
It is. It was almost just, I think it was the legend, the fact that it's sort of told as a legend and it's a ghost story, you know, and that's sort of what it's meant to be. It's not in itself supernatural, but it's just a retelling of some myth, you know, and that for that reason, it's my number five. I love it. It always takes me back to my childhood and I watch it every year.
Yeah. Very cool. I'm already glad we didn't, send our lists to each other prior to talking. I'm enjoying the surprise, because this is one that didn't occur to me. But now that I think about it, yeah, that's a very good pick. Okay, well, my number five is one that might surprise a lot of people on this list as well, although it's very different. My number five top horror film is The Terminator.
Oh, okay.
And of course, you know, most people know 1984, directed by James Cameron, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, and what's his name? Johnny Ringo. And Michael Biehn, right? Michael Biehn.
Yeah, Johnny Ringo.
Yeah, that's one I need to rewatch that I haven't watched in probably about a decade, is Tombstone. But anyway, Terminator may surprise people. It'd probably be on a lot of people's lists for like great action movies or great sci-fi movies. And that's how people mostly think of it. They think of it primarily as an action film and a sci-fi film. And if they think a little bit deeper about it, they think, oh, it's basically a Messiah story. I mean, the Messiah in this case is named John Connor. He's got the initials JC. It's like, you know, it's very much like a Jesus Messiah story in a sci-fi setting, where the Terminator is like the Pharaoh trying to kill him, you know, trying to kill the Messiah, although in this case with time travel before he's born and all these sorts of things. But to me, Terminator has always been first and foremost a horror film. And here's why. Because I saw it really young. It was the first R-rated movie I saw. My parents probably wouldn't have let me see it if they had known that I was going to see it. I was at a neighbor's house who was babysitting me, and one of their kids put it on. And I sat and watched it, and I was probably around five. This would have been, you know, not long after the thing came on VHS. And I sat and watched Terminator, and I was terrified. And if you think about it, in many ways, the Terminator is like a horror movie slasher, because, you know, he's a cyborg and he uses guns a lot of the time. But other than that, he's a very similar archetypal sort of a thing as someone like Michael Myers. Yeah. His origin is different. His nature is different. But like, in broad brush terms, he's this soulless, pitiless, remorseless, seemingly unstoppable dark stranger.
Yeah.
And then there's elements of gore too, like when he starts to get mutilated and like pokes his own eye out and whatever. And so anyway, around age five, this is the first film that I can vividly remember to this day. And I don't have very many memories clear from that early in my life. This is one I can remember, the earliest film I can remember being like genuinely scared and disturbed, and like it resonating with me for days afterward, where I was like, you know, mildly traumatized, was the Terminator. So I say it's also a horror film.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And it's interesting that we both picked something that had a childhood impact for our initial entries. It's so funny how like those memories and those experiences, particularly in the genre of horror, stick with you forever. I think John Carpenter had said in an interview, the first story ever told was probably a ghost story, which is true. Like, it's being scared and terrified is just, you know, it's part of the human condition. And that what you're saying about the Terminator is an often used trope. The Terminator, you know, himself is just that the unstoppable force. You know, it doesn't matter what it is,
whether the shape, like Michael Myers.
Yeah, the shape. It's, you know, or the zombie or whatever it happens to be, or the nothing, if you want to go into something fantastic like the Neverending Story. It's whenever your protagonists are dealing with the unstoppable force, always more scary, right? It's that's a really interesting pick. I would not have selected that, but now that you say it, yeah, I guess it is a horror film.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, you know, if you're dealing with like a human killer, no matter how dangerous or scary they are, it's like, all right, if you can shoot them well with a sufficiently powerful gun, it is done. Whereas the Terminator, they shoot the shit out of them, and it just kind of mildly slows them down a little bit, and that's about it, you know. So, and it's more plausible because he's a cyborg. Whereas, you know, with Michael Myers, you're just kind of left wondering, like, what is he really? Which, you know, is its own thing, I guess. But but there is something about it being almost like scientifically more plausible that this thing is unstoppable. So anyway, your number four.
All right, my number four, we're going in a totally different direction. This was something that I saw as a teenager that really scared me and stuck with me. And it's completely different than sort of my playful number five pick. So I'm going with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1974 by Tobe Hooper, who also did one of my honorable mentions, which would be Poltergeist. He did that with Steven Spielberg. But I picked the Texas Chainsaw Massacre because I think that's his best piece, especially as an auteur where he had a pretty much, you know, ran the whole show. It was really interesting to me because when I first saw it, I didn't know a lot about film at the time, and I was just starting to get into scary movies, and I thought it was going to be kind of silly in a way. I was like, I thought it was going to be like almost, I don't want to say slapstickish, but just kind of dumb. And then when I watched it, it has like this grainy film quality. It looks almost like a documentary. I mean, it looks so real.
Yeah, yeah. It almost anticipates all those, you know, found footage horror
in
films.
The beginning, there's this creepy narration in the beginning where they're talking about how like it's a true story and all this stuff. I mean, very loosely kind of based on Ed Gein, who was a real life serial killer and grave robber. But you know, as were other films and books and things like this, that some of which we might get into later, so I don't want to go into those. But it was like banned in a lot of places when it first came out. It caused all kinds of problems. And I think it was shot for $140,000, which I think today would be something like $700,000 or $800,000. But it was really ahead of its time as far as using a really small budget and just with a good idea, you could really accomplish something and you could go make something for a group of, you know, young actors and director, Tobe Hooper, could go make something that stands the test of time. And I think a lot of it is to do with the performances, you know, Tobe Hooper's eye for what to show and what not to show. Like a lot of people think that it's a really gory film. And the first one is not. There is not a whole lot of blood shown. There's the, I was watching an interview with Tobe Hooper. I think the interview was from the Masters of Horror series. And he talks about how like, yeah, the blood is, he gets it out of your mind. You know, obviously there's the scene he references is where Leatherface takes the girl and puts her on the meat hook. And he's like, yeah, I pan down to a big bucket, you know, and you know, obviously know the bucket's there to catch the blood and stuff, but I don't show the blood, you know? So, and then after several rewatchings of the film, I realized, yeah, there's not a lot of blood in it at all. There's not a lot of gore. It's all, but I had to like rewatch it to realize that because of how artful it was done. And it really scared me. It was one that the first, like based on a true story kind of, even though that's definitely a very far cry, a lot of rationalization there, but that made me think like, oh, this could happen. It's very believable. And it could. And I guess that's the scary thing is none of the characters are supernatural. They're just crazy weirdos. You know, so, and it has the unsuspecting characters, you know, just the teenagers who are out, a lot of the, you know, the tropes that you run into in slasher films, but this was an early entry in the slasher genre, and I think it's one of the best. So number four, it definitely scared me when I was a teenager, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, I like that one too. It's not in my top list. It would definitely be on like a longer list for me, like 20 or 25 or something. I think I didn't actually see that one until I was a little bit older. And so it probably, you know, some of this, like you said before, has to do with like when you encounter certain things and, you know, something like if I encountered Terminator when I was 25, it probably wouldn't have felt as terrifying. I would have just been like, wow, yeah, this is a cool action movie, you know? And so, yeah, I think if I had actually seen Texas Chainsaw, the original, a little bit younger than I did, it might have impacted me a bit more. But definitely I agree that, you know, it is very good. And It, along with some movies that are on my lists or on my runners up, are similar in regard of shot on a shoestring and kind of guerrilla filmmaking. And, you know, when you've got a skilled filmmaker, that can really bring out some.
And it's different for anyone who hasn't seen it that's listening. It's completely different than any of the other entries into the series. So don't go Netflix Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 and think that it is anything remotely like the original. It is completely, it's a standalone piece. The other ones are just sort of spoofs almost. They're kind of ridiculous to where this one has a more serious, sinister tone. It isn't about the gore or anything like that. It's more about a scary story.
Yeah, it definitely does a good job with the ominous mood that I'm always a big fan of. Well, my number four is one you mentioned earlier. It is Jaws, 1975, directed by Señor Spielbergo.
A sophomore effort.
Yeah. This is, again, we're back to childhood. This is the second movie I can remember seeing that really made me viscerally afraid. The first being Terminator. And even though Jaws is an older film, I didn't see it until probably a year or two after I saw Terminator. So this is the second one I can really clearly remember that like gave me a lasting little bit of trauma. And, you know, it's so well done in terms of you don't really see the shark for most of the movie till near the end. And a lot of that was the luck that the robot shark malfunctioned so much that Spielberg had to imply things. With his filmmaking, and that actually makes for a much more suspenseful movie. And the fact that while certain aspects of the shark and how they kill it and the things the shark does are obviously exaggerated and not realistic, but the idea that, you know, a big shark could potentially eat you is something that does happen. It's not statistically super common, but it does happen. So there's a plausibility there that, like, you know, a gargoyle eating you or who knows what is, you know, not the same like feeling of, hey, this is actually kind of possible, which makes Jaws all the more scary. And, you know, they didn't make the shark behave as cartoonishly, stupidly ridiculous as a lot of later shark movies that go nuts with the special effects and the sharks are practically like able to fly.
I think it still looks great. I think the shark still looks good. Like it's obviously, you have to realize you're dealing with, what year was it? Do you remember? It's obviously they're dealing with 1975 technology, but I it's still effective for me.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah. The one thing is the jaw itself, you can tell is mechanical. When the shark sticks his head out of the water and, you know, chews on something, you can sort of see the joint there for the jaw. But other than that, it does at least look more realistic than a CGI shark. You know, those practical effects, for all their flaws, are oftentimes still less fake looking than the damn CGI that everybody abuses.
These I agree. Days.
And Jaws is another one of these, you know, that you combine the less is more filmmaking with, of course, the iconic John Williams soundtrack that just immediately, you know what it is and it's terrifying. And for me in particular, that I saw it still relatively young, probably 6 or 7 the first time. And I grew up in Florida, so guess what? I'm in and around the water all the time from the time I'm a toddler. So it's one where, you know, if you live nowhere near the ocean and you're not in the water much or whatever, maybe Jaws won't put the fear in you as much as someone who is growing up constantly in and around the water. So that's another reason it just really extra kind of punched me in the nuts.
It is a movie that literally kind of changed everyone's behavior about going in the water for a long time. Like it actually had a appreciable effect on how much people were scared of going into the ocean for a while. So that's pretty interesting. I had a friend years ago named Natalie. She used to live here. Now she lives in California. And there's a quarry or something out there in California where people will go, and there's actually like a, it's like almost like a drive-in at a quarry, which it sounds awesome. Like I would love to do that. And they will show Jaws sometimes and other, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon and things like this that have to do with water as the setting. And they'll show, and people are sitting there in their rafts or whatever, you know, watching this stuff. So that has to be kind of a cool experience. But no, I love Jaws. It was his Spielberg's second movie. He did Duel. before that, which, just as a little side note, was written by Richard Matheson, who makes a couple appearances for me later on. So a shout out to one of my favorite authors, Richard Matheson, who inspired Spielberg and then a bunch of other people. But it was very early in his career, and it's still one of his most brilliant films, I think.
Yeah, that's one I haven't seen in a long time that could probably use a rewatch. Yeah, and by the way, before we move off from Jaws, just real quick, I can tell you that there were a few times where I had an uneasy feeling while in a swimming pool after seeing Jaws. Like, no joke. I'd be in a swimming pool, and my mind knows, like, there is not going to be a shark in the swimming pool. And yet my subconscious reptilian brain still is like hearing the theme music and feeling just that, that uneasy sort of feeling, like, especially when you're not, you're in the deep end.
He's going to bust through the foundation of the pool.
He's going to, I don't know. He's going to shrink and then come in through the pipes and, I mean, that to me, that's proof of an effective film that you can be scared in a swimming pool after you see it. So, all right. Your
number three is probably one of the most known and classic horror films of all time, which is Night of the Living Dead, 1968, George Romero.
Excellent pick. I will say right now, no joke, it's my number three.
So we can just talk about this one together. We can go back and forth on it. I'll tell you some of the things that I love about it, and then you can tell me what you love about it so much. I love that it's in black and white. I think it makes it more effective than the remake, which is also good, done by Tom Savini, who was a special effects guy for Romero for years for all the other zombie films that he did. And he was, Tom Savini was actually, if people have seen Dawn of the Dead, he was, I forget his name in that, but he was the guy who had like the pants on that fold and the crotch folded down into like a gun to shoot the vampires. So like that's Tom Savini. Right. But anyway, he's great. But the original one from 1968 was done for like $100,000 or something like that, something in the neighborhood there. And it's just another example of something that was done cheaply that changed movies. It literally changed the genre. He created an entire type of monster, basically, in 1968 that people are still replicating today. And you look at The Walking Dead, you look at all these other films, he really is the one who created the rules around this particular monster. And there are so many political and philosophical symbolic things that can go into what it's really about. It's one of these things that's a horror movie that just says a little bit more. It starred Dwayne Jones, who stars as Ben, which is the main protagonist of the film. And really, this was one of the first times an African-American actor was put as a leading role. And it was done in a little horror film, that was shot outside of Pennsylvania, not for some big studio. And it just doesn't get enough love for stuff like that, as this genre is often dismissed. But it does some pretty important things, and that's one of them.
Yeah. I love all those things about it, definitely. And it's the first, and in my mind, still the best of kind of the modern zombie films. And I think it still stands up pretty well. Like, it's still a creepy, scary movie.
The sound design is great in it.
Yeah. And I appreciate it even more now that I know more about how it was made and all that sort of stuff. And I actually mentioned it in my presentation at Porkfest like 3 years ago as an example of applying guerrilla principles to something other than war. And I mentioned there, and I'll mention here, anybody who's a fan of this movie who's not already, go watch the documentary Birth of the Living Dead. That is a documentary film about the making of Night of the Living Dead. It is excellent. Yeah. It's last time I checked, it's on Amazon Prime streaming if you have that. And you'll get a whole new level of appreciation for this film if you watch that documentary. It's just amazing what they were able to do. Classic case of someone with very few resources.
It was also
being extremely resourceful.
Again, because it just ties into Jaws, what we were talking about before. Very much inspired by I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Again, the same author. In fact, I had watched an interview with Romero before where he was like, I just ripped off a lot of what Richard Matheson was doing, you know. He's like, it's still enough of his own to where, as John Carpenter has put it before, he created this whole world, you know, which he did. And I think it's a masterpiece still today, and probably of the entire series, I would say Dawn of the Dead being a close second, still it's the very best one.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite in all those. All right, so let's see if we have another one where we both happen to pick the same one for the same number.
My number two pick is, I'm going to say, if you put a gun to my head and said, what's your favorite film of all time? I would probably pick this one. And that's going to be the 1979 Alien by Ridley Scott. So there's a lot of reasons why it's my favorite movie. In fact, a while back, I did an entire podcast on just Alien. So, but I think it's got a lot of the things that we've already talked about. It's a horror movie similar to how you saw Terminator. It's a horror movie that's in space. You know, it's I guess the classic thing said about it is it's a haunted house movie in space. You know, there's this monster that's on the loose terrorizing these people. And the setting is just this claustrophobic spaceship. And it's got all the elements of a great horror film. It's got some jump scares, but it doesn't abuse the technique. It's got a great monster in the Alien that, again, has gone on to be in numerous sequels and spinoffs and everything else. A phenomenal cast, including Tom Skerritt, Sigourney Weaver, you know, just a bunch of Ridley Scott is an amazing director. And it was written by Dan O'Bannon. Dan O'Bannon is a name that comes up a lot when you're talking about a lot of the, especially once we get into talking about short stories and adaptations and films. He's a writer. He did a lot of work on different films, and he was actually a good friend of John Carpenter's. They went to film school together at USC and actually worked on their first student film, which became their first real film after they got some financing, called Dark Star. And that was actually the, as O'Bannon puts it, the germ for Alien. Alien, if you get the special DVD collector's series, has one of the best behind the scenes. I think it's called The Beast Within or something. It's got one of the best making of that I've ever seen. And I really like it. I think it's a good example of like how sometimes Hollywood or whatever catches lightning in a bottle, because you had a great writer in O'Bannon, and you had a great director in Ridley Scott, who's very much an auteur, but does allow other people's input. You had O'Bannon brought all these, he had been working on Dune, a version of Dune, which never got made. And he met H.R. Giger, who did the Alien, and a bunch of other artists who all came together. He got sort of like this dream team of artists to work together, and they each designed a different aspect of it. So he had one artist designing the Alien, who was Giger, and another artist designing the spaceship, and another artist is, so there, all these elements are coming from different brains. So that's why like the Alien and the Alien planet and the Alien ship feel so distinct from the rest of the film, because they were worked on by different people, by different artists, and using that technique really makes them seem otherworldly. But it's scary, and the characters are great. I could go on and on and on about it. I love it. It'll always be one of my favorites, but there you go. Alien.
Good pick. I'm definitely a fan. It wouldn't quite make my top five, but it's definitely on my list of runners up. And another thing that it does so well is, and I think you probably mentioned this in the podcast you did on it way back when, which I did listen to at the time. One of the things that makes Alien so effective is that the crew and their personalities and their banter and kind of just the look and feel of their spaceship, and it has a very authentic feel, even though it's this, yeah, you know, sci-fi thing. You have this feeling of like, oh, these are believable blue collar characters who are kind of like the space equivalent of truckers.
Yes.
And all of that feeling of realness in the characters, and even in like the appearance of their ship, you know, that it's kind of beat up and dingy and whatever,
again, makes it so much more easy to, you know, buy the fantastical alien and all of that. So yeah, it's very effective.
I think the guy who worked on the ship, I'm not 100% sure, but I think his name is Ron Cobb. I'm almost positive. Yeah, it was Ron Cobb, Chris Foss, and H.R. Giger. And Chris Foss did a lot of the more fantastical elements of like the design of, you know, the actual atmosphere of space and everything. But Chris Foss is an artist, and he did a lot of the ship. And when he was doing it, he has like an engineer's mind, and he designed a lot of these things like they would actually work. He had this whole, and I'll quote him, space would be at a premium, you know, on a spaceship like this. So, you know, he talked a lot about how when he was doing the art design, he wanted to really capture that sensibility of, I want this to work. And the set, when they created the set, they built a spaceship. Like basically they got all these different parts from the studio and from junkyards and everything else. And they built it and painted it. And the actual set was like you were going into this spaceship, at least on the inside. And they actually had to film in a very claustrophobic type of atmosphere. And it definitely had an impact on the actors and on the filmmaking in general, the lighting, very, very sparsely lit. And it's just great. I think for all those reasons, it's a great example of when all those things sort of come together to make something that ends up standing the test of time. And it is by far, I think, the best in the series of all any of the series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question. And it does age well. It does stand up precisely for the reason you were saying, because these are all practical effects. These are real built sets. And so everything looks and feels real. Whereas if they made it today, they'd probably just CGI every damn thing and it would not feel as real.
Yeah. When they did that, the egg burst, the face hugger scene where the egg opens and boom, out shoots the face hugger that attaches to one of the astronauts. They used like sheep intestine or something like that. And some seafood stuff or something like that, shot with an air cannon. And then they had to slow it down. And one of the things Ridley Scott was saying, in that behind the scenes footage, he was like, you can't get any better than the real thing. You know, in essence, that's what they're using there. They're using visceral, actual material. Nothing like that holds up forever. Yeah. You know, that's just looking at an actor's face or a physical human being. Yeah. So I think that's why it's so good.
Yep. Okay. My number two is one that most people have probably seen. The Exorcist, 1973, William Friedkin, based on the novel by William Peter Blatty. And in my mind, it is the best of the demonic possession films. It's really, as far as I know, the first of the big modern ones to have that be sort of the main theme. And I think it is the best of those sorts of films because of, well, a number of things, you know, obviously the actors, the performances, the directing, all that, but the sound, the iconic soundtrack, and that sense of realism you get, it does a great job slowly building things and making it feel plausible and the world feels real and all that sort of thing, and uses a few jump scares, but mostly relies on atmosphere slowly, ominously building, and just a great film in terms of mood and all that. It's just the most plausible of these sort of possession subgenre movies.
Yeah, and I also think that of all those kind of movies, it definitely personifies like the good versus evil the best. Like that's ultimately, it's a good versus evil film, and it's extremely scary. This is one that's difficult for me to watch. Like I have trouble with this one just because it is so creepy, and it does come from such a kind of a real place, you know, and it's definitely a very scary pick. Great number two.
So what is your number one?
All right. I don't know if we have the same number one. I think we might, because you haven't mentioned it yet, but maybe not. So I know we both have this one director that we both very much admire, but I'm going with Halloween 1978, John Carpenter.
I strongly concur.
I was like, man, he better not sneak Escape from New York. That's not horror. He cannot do this. So at least we both have Halloween on here, produced by the great Deborah Hill. She's prolific in her own right. Starring Jamie Lee Curtis, obviously, who, you know, most people know, I guess, the daughter of Janet Lee, who was famous for Psycho. And the great Donald Pleasance, who reprises his role in all the sequels. But it's really about this first one, Halloween. It is the king of slasher movies, the king of indie films, held numerous records for a long time of, money made versus money spent. It did phenomenally in that regard. Made a name for John Carpenter. It was his first big film. John Carpenter, in my mind, is the ultimate auteur. I don't think he gets nearly enough credit. And I will say he was one of the first people who started putting his name. He was smart enough, to include his name as part of the title in his films, to let you know, hey, this is my creation. He's very much an auteur. You would see it with Alfred Hitchcock before, and maybe if you go way back, David O. Selznick was probably, who did the Ten Commandments and big epics like this, was probably one of the only people doing it. But he brought that sensibility of like, hey, this is the director's film. And I could go on and on about John Carpenter. I love virtually all of his films. Escape from New York is one of my favorite, where I'm going to talk about him more later. So, great movie. I want to know what you have to say about it.
Yeah, well, I already said a bunch about it back when I did my DHP Heroes John Carpenter stuff about a year ago. So any listeners who haven't heard that can go check that out for much more just of my take on John Carpenter plus, sort of a biographical narrative of his career. It is actually probably not my number one top favorite John Carpenter movie, but it's my number one top favorite John Carpenter movie that's first and foremost a horror movie. And obviously it is my top favorite horror movie. And yeah, I mean, I think it's the ultimate slasher film. All others are inferior to one degree or another. It is a classic case of less is more and minimalism and using suspense and implying things and not just relying on just jump scares or just gore or whatever as a shortcut or a crutch. And like Texas Chainsaw, it's surprisingly bloodless given sort of how people normally think of it. And like Night of the Living Dead and like some others we've mentioned, it's again, wonderful case of shoestring budget being used effectively to make something that's better than most big budget films. One of the most profitable films of all time. And it makes my list, especially since we're talking about this less than a week before Halloween.
Exactly.
Because not only is it a great horror movie, but it's a great seasonal film, even though it was shot, I think, during the summer in California. And it's supposed to be, in Ohio in the autumn. But nonetheless, if you really look at the background, you can catch this, but you can catch that it's not really autumn in the north. But
they had to spread dead leaves around for some of the shots.
Yeah, and they were like,
and they said it was a pain in the ass, like going to clean them up for each take and then drop them again.
Yeah, they
had to
recycle them. Yeah, they were keeping like garbage bags full of dead leaves. but despite all that, it still just gives you this Halloween feel. And like so many of my favorites, it is great at slowly building an ominous atmosphere and just ratcheting it up.
Oh, the payoff at the end is amazing. Like the showdown between Michael Myers and Jamie Lee Curtis is just so good. It's the payoff, it's what you're waiting the whole film for. There's a lot of long shots that he sets up to where you're not quite sure. Is he in the background? Is he not in the background? Or you're seeing it from the character's perspective.
Yeah.
And it, like you said, it's the ultimate slasher flick. It is the best, and it doesn't rely on too many cheap jump scares or anything like that. It's just really, really well done.
Yeah, expertly shot too. All those times where like Michael Myers is off in the background, out of focus, and those sorts of shots where it's just perfect. for what it is, it is a perfect film.
And you know, you're talking, he's the writer, director, sound design, did the soundtrack, like, so it is truly his film.
Yeah, and I'll say this, and I said it back when I did my John Carpenter episodes, I really, really would love to see Carpenter crank out one more really good film with him as the auteur, because he hasn't done anything in a long time, and his last few films have either been bad or at least just, you know, not great. And I think that's really a shame, because when he's good, he's really good.
Yeah, when he's on, it's 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, again, hopefully we'll talk about more later.
Yeah, yeah. And he's getting on in years, and you know, I know he's been a chain smoker almost his whole life. So
yeah,
I'm like, come on, man, you don't have much time. Make one more awesome film. Like, shoot yourself up with whatever, you know, feel good stuff you need to you know, B12 and amphetamines or whatever it is you need to go out there and crank out one more brilliant film.
Yeah. And a lot of his great ones aren't horror films. Like, we've already Escape from New York, you know, I'm not going to go into all of them.
Yeah. But Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really good. I think, I'm not sure. No, it was Jeff Bridges who won an Academy Award for Starman. I don't think Carpenter did, but even like a love story he's done, you know, which is what that really was. But, you know, very, very interesting. Very interesting guy. A lot of libertarian sensibilities. Very, very likable character. Every interview that's like on YouTube or whatever that I can find with him, it's always interesting just to hear him talk. So,
yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed the research I did for those episodes. I read, you know, multiple biographies and things, and then watched a whole bunch of interviews and a whole bunch of, you know, making ofs of his various films and things like that. And it was a lot of fun just working on those, because, you know, I already knew a fair about him and his career, but to really dive deep. All right. Well, I guess we ought to just sort of sprint through our runners up, so that we can move on to the next category. So just, I'll just bang through mine fairly quick, maybe say a thing or two about a few of them, but most of them I'll just list. And these are in no particular order. I didn't rank my runners up or organize them by date or anything. So, Alien, which you already mentioned, that's a runner up.
Okay.
The Changeling, 1980, starring George C. Scott, is a very good, kind of.
Yes. I love that movie.
Story. Yeah. Ghost haunting sort of a story. Very good. The Others with Nicole Kidman, 2001, is another one I like. Once you know the twist ending, it's a little bit less scary, but the first time you watch that movie, I think it is very, very good.
Yeah.
The Fog, John Carpenter, 1980.
Yes, yes.
Not the 2005 remake, the original. More recent one, The Woman in Black, 2012, starring Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter.
Okay.
Very effective, suspenseful, haunting sort of a movie that I would highly recommend. Seven, 1995, directed by David Fincher.
Ooh, yeah, so, that's great. Great movie. Yeah,
Fincher is awesome whenever he's dealing with serial killers. so, yeah, any of his movies, and also Mindhunter on Netflix, the series.
Did he do Zodiac?
Yes, and that, okay. I'll spoil it, is one of my honorable mentions for underappreciated horror films. So yeah, I'm a big fan. There's a few things he's done that I'm not a fan of, but when he's dealing with serial killers, he's just awesome at it.
Yeah.
And then on my honorable mentions, the original Wicker Man, 1973.
Oh, very, very, very awesome movie.
Yeah, Edward Woodward and Christopher Lee, not the horrible Nicolas Cage remake. Another one, much more recent, It Follows, 2014. Mm-hmm. That one almost made my top five list, honestly. It does, I think, a very effective job with all the things I like. Ominous mood, realism that then makes you buy the supernatural element. And it's one of the few movies I've seen, say, made in the last 5 years or so that, like, really, really had an impact on me and really, you know, struck me as a powerful horror movie. And then a few anthology films. I love anthology horror films, and none of them I don't think are quite good enough to make my top five, but just a few anthology horror films I'm a big fan of that I'll mention briefly, and then I'll turn it over to you. Creepshow, Creepshow 2, Trick or Treat, which is one from 2007, and Tales of Halloween, which is from 2015. Those are a few anthology films, which are pretty good. There's been some bad anthology films. I don't love them all, but a good anthology film I usually like, you know, where you got these little 15-minute segments. Oh, and also in that vein, the Twilight Zone film from the 80s.
Yeah, that's really good. With Jonathan Lithgow.
Yeah.
That's good. And that was a collaboration. There was a few different directors that worked on that.
A lot of anthology films will be that way, where they'll have a different director for each segment.
I think Creepshow as well was like that.
Yeah, and that's, I can't remember if Trick or Treat was that way or not, but it definitely is the case with Tales of Halloween. Anyway, do you want to run through your runners up?
I do. So my runners up for ones that I would, consider putting in the top, but they just didn't quite make the cut. Obviously, Nightmare on Elm Street, I'm a Wes Craven fan. The original one, I think, is really good. The original, I'd say the Bela Lugosi Dracula film, I think, is really good. It's got that creepy sort of atmosphere. It's very, very old. A movie called Alice, Sweet Alice, which is a very early kind of precursor to the slasher film. It's also like a psychological thriller. Suspiria. As far as modern films, The Descent, which is about a group of girls who go cave diving, go like spelunking.
Yeah, that one's pretty good. I remember that one.
Yeah, that's pretty, very claustrophobic feeling. And then there's another one called Oculus. That's pretty good, which is about a haunted mirror.
Oh, yeah. You know, I had forgotten about that one. Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. So those weren't quite good enough to make it onto the list. I already mentioned Poltergeist. But those will probably be ones that were really close. And I will give just another quick honorable mention to Halloween 3. It's the only Halloween that isn't in the Michael. So when they did Halloween, they were originally going to take it as an anthology series, which they very well should have, instead of doing like Michael Myers sequels. Halloween 3 was the first one that did something different. And, It's a really weird movie. It's very eerie and creepy, and it has androids in it, which creep me out. Like, I don't like human looking androids like that. Maybe part of the reason why I think Alien's so great is because the Ash character. But that's something that's always scared me, is something that looks human that isn't. Mm-hmm. So Halloween 3 definitely was really close to being on one of my lists. So I think that's a good entry into the franchise, because it doesn't have anything to do with Michael Myers.
No, it's pretty good. All right, well, now underappreciated or unsung or lesser known favorite horror films, and the ones I've got, probably most of them are ones that horror fans will know, so they're not ones that are so esoteric that you know, a reasonable horror film fan is going to not have a clue. There might be one or two that might, you know, be unknown to horror fans, but they are ones that probably just the sort of general population people who aren't really horror fans or horror buffs, but who just, you know, dabble in it occasionally, and probably, you know all my top five films, might not know these, or might vaguely have heard of them, but not have seen them or whatever. So, That's kind of the criteria I was thinking of there when I put together my list. I don't know if you were.
I bet I know you're number one. I'm not going to say anything, but I feel like I know you well enough to know, and your sensibilities, what your number one pick is. But I'm not going to say anything.
I don't know. My number one pick here might actually surprise you. We'll see. Number five. What's your number five?
So I took a little different of a direction. Mine, most people probably do know. I kept it fairly mainstream. I'm like so into film and have been sort of into this world of film analysis for so long, since I went to school for it, that I'm at a point where I really don't even know what is obscure anymore. So I tried to keep it somewhat mainstream. So I think most people will have heard of most of these, but I just think they might not be looked at as horror films necessarily. So things that I think are worth a watch if you're looking for a horror film that you wouldn't necessarily equate as a horror film right off the get-go. So number five is a very popular movie. Some people might consider it one of the best films of all time, but I just don't think that they would consider it a horror film. And that is Rear Window by Alfred Hitchcock, 1954, which to me is his best film. It is amazing for one of the main reasons that we actually talked about in a sidebar conversation earlier before we started recording, which was the horror of having something taken away from you that physically handicaps you, which is the situation the main character is dealing with in the story. So he's sort of this adventure kind of guy, who's played by Jimmy Stewart, who's incredible, of course. And he's broken his leg and he's in a wheelchair and he cannot leave his apartment. And he believes he's seen a murder or something through his binoculars. He starts spying on his neighbors in this apartment complex. And he's trying to solve this murder. And the whole film is shot from the apartment, from his point of view or the character's point of view, because, you know, the other characters come into it as well. But it's the camera doesn't leave the apartment. And that is so groundbreaking for 1954 and amazing that Alfred Hitchcock, again, an amazing auteur, could bring so much suspense and power into one point of view. A close contender for this one, I did want to include a Hitchcock film, was going to be Rope, which was done in one continuous shot. There are cuts in it because they didn't have enough film to do it in one shot, but it's one shot about a couple of guys who do like a kill just for the fun of it. And everything takes place in their apartment and they have friends over and they're trying to hide the body. And it's really, really insane kind of film. And that was groundbreaking as well, but I had to stick with Rear Window. If you want to be scared in a kind of a suspenseful kind of way, I think that's the Alfred Hitchcock film to watch. In my opinion, I think it's his number one.
Interesting choice. Very good movie. It's one of those ones that I wouldn't have thought of first and foremost as a horror film, but I can definitely see it. My number five is Cabin in the Woods, 2012.
Oh, that's a great modern one. Yeah.
Yeah. Directed by Drew Goddard. And of course, Joss Whedon co-wrote it with him and also was the producer on it. So there's a Whedon influence as well. And that's one I've been meaning to rewatch because I haven't watched it in a while, but I think this is the best of the horror films that are semi-satirical and meta, which is almost like its own subgenre of horror films, where it's like you're combining some actual horror with these satirical and even humorous angles and also doing like a meta commentary on the horror genre itself. And I think this movie, to me, does that the best, balances those different things the best of any movie that's tried. I do personally, I think it is far superior to Scream. It's a very different movie, but it has, again, that meta and somewhat satirical element to it. I think Cabin in the Woods is superior to Scream. I personally think that I think that Scream is very overrated. I don't think it's Wes Craven's best work at all. And I don't think I'm as much of a Wes Craven fan as you are, but anyway, Cabin in the Woods, it's a lot of fun. And especially the first time you watch it, you don't see where it's going. I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to spoil too much of the plot. If any listener hasn't seen it yet, needs to go check it out. I'm not going to get into much of the details, but you're not going to see where it's going, I don't think.
All right. I think that's a great number five.
Yeah. And while it had a cult following ever since it came out, it's one that, again, the mainstream non-horror buff types may not really be aware of. So what's your next pick for underappreciated horror film?
I believe it's the only remake on any of my lists or anything like that. I'm going with the 1982 The Thing, John Carpenter, another appearance by John Carpenter.
Good choice.
Yep, written by Bill Lancaster. It's based on the pretty popular Who Goes There novella, titled Who Goes There by John Campbell Jr. in 1938. I think it captures the novella. I left the novella off my list. I was going to put Who Goes There on one of my other lists, but I didn't because the film captures it so well. And I think it does a better job than the 1951 black and white film, The Thing from Another World, which also takes its inspiration from the novella. It kind of goes against some of the conventions we were talking about earlier about how less is more. This is one of the films on my list that shows everything. The Thing was sort of famous for what John Carpenter said, bringing it out into the light. It's all practical, but they shot them in a way that's so brilliant and so believable and so real that it just looks absolutely incredible. The special effects they were able to pull off are great. And how I told you before that, like, androids kind of creep me out. The Thing has that same sort of sensibility where you don't really know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. It can look like anything. It can be anything. Is somebody infected? Is this person not infected? That suspense that you don't know what's going on is really frightening to me. And one of the elements of horror that really gets to me.
Yeah.
And is present in one of my short stories for sure later that we'll talk about. But that sense of dread and paranoia, that heightened sense of paranoia, I just, the Thing yeah. captures it wonderfully. So I love that movie. It's one of my favorite movies, but it probably should have nudged something out from being on the list, but I already had a Carpenter film in my top five. So I had to move this one down to number four, but there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, The Thing would be one of my honorable mentions for this category for sure. And yeah, I agree with that completely. It's a masterpiece, not only of ominous building suspense
yeah.
and like just this bleak atmosphere feel to it, but then you add the paranoia in on top
of it. A sense of doom, you know, just even in the end, it's just that you have this sense of doom.
Yeah. Yeah. Just nihilism in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just this unspoken undercurrent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my number four is my favorite Wes Craven movie, not one of his best loved films, but it is for me. And it's the only Wes Craven film that I really love. There's a few others that I like, but this is the only one that I really love. And it is The Serpent
it's
in the
so
Rainbow.
So good. Yes. Yeah.
1988. Yeah. Bill Pullman, I think right around the same time he was Lone Star, give or take a year. And it is, I think, very
absolutely.
Underrated as a horror film. There's a bunch of other Wes Craven films that often get, you know, much more love from horror buffs, but I think this, maybe it's because this is the one he did that's the most in line with what I really like in a horror movie.
Psychological terror. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So for those who haven't seen it, I'll just say that it is a zombie film that's unlike every other zombie film around because it deals with the actual kind of Haitian Caribbean original mythology and, you know, how much of that is real and all these sorts of things. And yeah, anyway, big fan. I think that
Me
movie
too.
Deserves a lot more love.
I'll give you a little hint. There's a reason it's not on my top five films. All right. So we might hear more about this later.
Okay. Okay. All right.
My number three is the 1981 Sam Raimi classic Evil Dead.
Okay.
He was the director and writer of it. And this introduced like Bruce Campbell to the horror scene as the character Ash, who's like my favorite supernatural horror hero. Just the idea of like, you know, and later in the sequels, he's got like a chainsaw arm, like he gets attached to his arm where he goes, kills demons and things. Like that's just a great hero. If I ever got another dog, I would name him Ash. Like I love the character that much. Yeah. It was made for under $500,000. You know, it was made for like $400,000. And it has a lot of the stuff that you've talked about, which is like guerrilla filmmaking. Like for a steady cam, they like mounted a camera to a board and two guys would just run around the woods with it because the demon, one of the demons, you just don't see. It's like a force in the woods and it's all done through point of view shot, which is chasing the characters. So again, it's got that grainy sort of gritty feel to it. And it's pretty terrifying if you watch it, but it's also a little bit slapstickish, not as much as the sequels are, but it's definitely underappreciated. Donnie Darko, the film, which is kind of a cult classic now, that's the film that they go watch in the film. there's a scene where Jake Gyllenhaal, his character is in the theater, and they're the only ones in the theater, him and his girlfriend. And that's what's playing sort of as homage to the Evil Dead, but it influenced a lot of people. I mean, now Sam Raimi's out there doing Spider-Man and everything else, and he's big time, but it's interesting to know a lot of these guys started in this genre where you can kind of do a lot with a little. And I think Evil Dead's a great example of that. And I think it's a good movie.
Yeah. That's one I need to go rewatch, because I think I saw it and I wasn't quite prepared to appreciate it. I actually didn't see the Evil Dead series in order. I saw Army of Darkness first when it came out.
that's just comedy.
Yeah. And I loved it. I loved it.
It's hilarious.
I went back and I watched, you know, the prequels to it. And I think they it didn't quite work for me at the time. I'm talking like,
give it another chance.
I'm talking 20 years ago. So, you know, my tastes have become more sophisticated, but I think probably what threw me for a loop was I was expecting it to just be like, you know, Army of Darkness prequels, and it wasn't. And I think that kind of threw me for a loop. Yeah. And I didn't quite know how to take it. So, I'll have to go take another look at that, because it's probably been 20. I think I've seen Evil Dead 2 more recently, but I don't.
Which is sort of Evil Dead 2 is like half remake, half sequel. It's really weird. In the first half of Evil Dead 2, they basically reshot and retell the first Evil Dead film, and then they go on to explain more of it. And that's where Ash is more developed further. And I like Evil Dead 2 also, but Evil Dead is where it started, and it has that more like they were trying to make a horror movie when they went out and did Evil Dead. When they did the sequels, they were trying to add a bunch of elements in there, which they did successfully, I think. And it's a fun series, but Evil Dead is actually scary.
Okay, I'll definitely have to go take another look at that, because it's probably been 20 years at this point. It's weird when you start getting to be old and things, you're like, oh yeah, it was recently. And you're like, oh, shit, that was 20 years ago, you know? Ugh. All right. Well, my number two in this category is probably what you were guessing would be my number one, I think. And that is...
Then it's going to be the same as my number two as well, I bet.
Prince of Darkness?
No, we're different. We're off. Ooh. We're different. Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Same director. Well,
okay. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of Carpenter films I could easily put on all these lists, but Prince of Darkness, 1987 is... in my opinion, the most underrated Carpenter film. I'm certainly not going to say it's his best, but most of his better films have a much bigger following proportionately, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like Prince of Darkness is a better horror film than it gets credit for being, even from most Carpenter fans.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think it is really good. Maybe one of the best movies ever at just establishing and building eerie, ominous, bleak atmosphere. Yeah. It is just so good at that, with all the techniques that he uses, soundtrack, everything, you know, the slow building, long shots, and how he does it with like the homeless people just showing up and standing looking creepily outside the old church.
Very bleak.
And the setting, it's this like postmodern urban shithole sort of setting. You know, it could be any bad part of town in any city. And, you know, it's of course shot in LA or whatever, but it could be almost anywhere that's got like a cruddy area, kind of post-industrial look to it, and don't really get very many answers. All these different, increasingly creepy things happen, and the protagonists of the film get trapped in a small claustrophobic location, mm-hmm. and they can't escape, which is, you know, a classic horror technique, and it's done very well, I think, in Prince of Darkness. So yeah, I'd say anybody who hasn't seen it, if you're a horror fan, you need to watch Prince of Darkness.
Man, that's a strong pick. I'm a little jealous, because that I do think that's so underappreciated. I agree 100%. I picked a more known Carpenter film for my number two. little film that's based on a 1963 short story by Ray Nelson called 8 o'clock in the Morning. And that's the 1988 They Live.
Oh yeah.
Which I think is one of the most underrated movies out there. I think it's the most overtly political of Carpenter's movies. I think he's like, it's, you really know that he's trying to make some statements in it. And I think it works well. I think he pulls it off because he doesn't sacrifice the story in doing that. It's still just a good movie. And it's got a really good cast. It's got Roddy Piper as our hero, who people from our generation, you know, what could be better than that? And the very underrated Keith David, who was also in The Thing. He's a Carpenter favorite. He was in Platoon, yep. The Quick and the Dead, Men at Work, Requiem for a Dream. I mean, if you just Wikipedia that guy's bibliography or his filmography, it's unbelievable.
Oh, and when you add to it his voice credits, either as a narrator or in animated stuff or whatever, I mean, he's just got one of the best voices ever. Everyone always says like, oh, I would want Morgan Freeman to narrate the movie about my life. And I say, yeah, he's my second choice. My first choice
Keith
to
David,
narrate a
yeah.
documentary is Keith David, if they're going to make a documentary about my life. Plus, he's the president in Rick and Morty. So, I mean, how can you beat that?
And I think he's in Armageddon, too. Isn't he like, he's the military guy or something. He's just a badass. Like, he's a badass yeah. in The Thing. Like, he's just... and then the fight scene between him and Roddy Piper, which is ridiculous and like goes on for like 10 minutes or something, and They Live, is just great. But it's yeah. about, you know, it's about seeing the world for what it really is. Really, when you look at the movie, it's about taking your blinders off, which they put sunglasses on in the movie
to right.
see what's really behind the curtain.
Yeah, yeah. Probably only The Matrix and The Red Pill is...
Yeah.
A better known metaphor than the sunglasses of They Live.
And this is better.
Yeah.
And it's about being woke.
Yeah. Yeah. In the true sense of the word.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. One of my favorite Carpenter movies. I actually don't normally think of it first and foremost as a horror movie, even though obviously it is, but like so many of Carpenter's films, it's genre blending. So,
yeah,
you know, it's everyone's subjective opinion. Like, which movie is more of a horror movie versus more of a sci-fi movie or a social commentary satirical movie or whatever. Yeah, but definitely a great movie regardless of how you parse its voodoo blend of different genres and different elements.
Yeah. My number one also, when we get there, you might have the same kind of feeling about it, that it doesn't necessarily belong.
Well, go ahead and drop it.
Well, one other thing I wanted to say about They Live is Nelson, who penned the story, he was really close friends with Philip K. Dick, who is one of my favorite. He's like, I have three favorite authors that I always say of all time, and that's Philip K. Dick, Kafka, and Cormac McCarthy. Those are my three favorite authors. And just the fact that they had a close relationship, you can really see the sensibility between this story and a lot of Dick's work.
Yeah, you know, of those three, Philip K. Dick is the only one I don't think I've ever read anything by him.
No, a master of the pulp genre, especially in science fiction, and he's got some big work that's pretty impressive, like Valis, and a lot of his stuff's been adapted for film. Total Recall, Blade Runner, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Total Recall, I think, was We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, Scanner Darkly. Just too many to list. Like his a favorite, A Minority Report, based on a short story. Just a lot of really, really creative science fiction work.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those authors. Like, I have every reason to believe I would probably love him.
You would, yeah.
just from what I know about him, and again, having seen all those films you've listed off, and probably others as well that are, you know, adaptations of his work. So yeah, just one of those things, you know, like that classic Seinfeld Twilight Zone episode, time enough to read.
Yeah. Right? Oh yeah.
Never have time. I've still, no matter how much I read fiction and nonfiction, I still always have like 800 books that I really want to read and just
yeah
can't get to. Cause
that's the one with Burgess Meredith, right?
Yeah. The upside of nuclear apocalypse, if you make it, is only time enough to read, right?
Yeah.
So what is your number one underappreciated horror film?
All right. My number one, I'm going out of the box here, of film per se. but I think it's, I can justify it. Mine is going to be the 1990 entire first season of Twin Peaks, the series, the television series. And this was done by David Lynch and Mark Frost. David Lynch is like the film version of Kafka. I mean, the same sensibilities are there, very dreamlike. This is horrifying. This is a horrifying story. If you look at the actual subject matter and what they're talking about, it's gut wrenching. But they do it in such a way that there's humor in there, supernatural elements in there, a lot of mystery. It's like a soap opera on steroids. And it's just got this dreamlike quality that could only be done with those two together. Mark Frost was a writer for Hill Street Blues, that was an early 80s like crime drama. And it was the first crime drama TV show to be like gritty and kind of real. And then he went on to work on Northern Exposure. But he kind of like, I think his sensibilities like reined Lynch in from like going total like Eraserhead and all that, like too abstract. So it's just a good marriage. And I think it made for just a really scary, fun, interesting thing. It's one of my favorite things, like, you know, ever put down on film is the first season of Twin Peaks and most of the second season. I remember when I first saw it, a friend of mine named David, when I was a kid, we were in high school, and he was like, oh man, you got to watch Twin Peaks. So he dropped the pilot on me, and there was this shitty little section. It was just one row of movies in, I think it was Blockbuster. I can't remember if it was still called Errol's. I think it was Blockbuster by this point, but it was called Cult Classics. And I would have to call around or even drive to the various Blockbusters in like the Northern Virginia area to piece together the entire series. I think it's eight hours. And one Blockbuster wouldn't have all of them, or they would all be rented or whatever. So it was like a journey. It was like this pilgrimage I had to make to complete the entire first season to watch it. And I got so addicted, but it's scary, creepy, disturbing. And it's nothing you could do on network TV today. Nothing. There's just no way some of the content in there would ever make it. Scary as hell. And just think it's super creative. That's my number one overlooked pick.
I will definitely have to check that out, because I have never actually sat down and watched Twin Peaks. It's one of those things, like, it was kind of around, you know, when you're growing up in the 90s. And yeah. I kind of was vaguely aware that there was some sort of weird show that a lot of people were really into. But like, for whatever reason, when it was still on TV and then even after the fact, it's just something I've never actually sat and watched.
It's brilliant. And it came out when I was in the seventh or eighth grade. So you were probably in the fifth or sixth grade or something like that. But I didn't watch it and I remember it being a thing even then. Like, people, what is this crazy thing people are watching? This is so crazy. And the log lady and all these zany characters that you hear about. And then it wasn't until I was in high school that actually my friend was like, you've never seen it? You got to watch it. And he was a film buff. And I watched it. And ever since then, I've been a Peaks freak. I've tried to turn as many people onto it as possible. So if you ever get a chance, the first season is probably hook you. Maybe you won't like it, but I think it's got enough creepiness to get you hooked.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad I'm getting all sorts of, you know, new stuff to check out in it, or old things I haven't seen in forever to go check out again. So my number one underappreciated, unsung, lesser known horror flick is one you may not have expected, but if you're familiar with it, you might understand why. It is Exorcist III, 1990. This one actually directed by William Peter Blatty himself, based on another Blatty novel called Legion. And it has relatively little to do with the original Exorcist, although it does deal with some of the same characters. But it's a very different sort of story. And
I've never seen it.
Exorcist III is definitely worth seeing. It stars George C. Scott.
Oh, wow.
And like I said, directed by Blatty, who, based on his novel Legion, which I also sort of think of as an underappreciated horror novel. Everybody knows The Exorcist, but Legion is worth reading. And it deals with a killer, a serial killer called the Gemini Killer. And most of the movie takes place in kind of like the mental ward of a hospital. And it has supernatural elements as well. And it is really another one of these movies where a lot of it is just based on suspense and atmosphere, and relatively little graphic stuff happens on screen, but it's talked about in different places. And it really, it in a way makes it creepier when they're talking about these horrible things and not showing it. And oh man, I'm blanking on, let me real quick pull up the actor who plays the Gemini Killer. He's a well-known character actor. He played a number of prominent roles. He was Grima Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
I'm blanking on his name. I gotta pull it up. He does a great job as this crazy serial killer. Brad Dourif is his name.
Okay. Yeah.
The guy who played Grima Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, and he also played one of the bad guys in Mississippi Burning, and he's been in a number of things. He's a really good character actor. I'm trying to think what else. He's just been in so many different things. But anyway, Exorcist 2 is dog shit. Everybody kind of knows that, who knows anything about horror films or the Exorcist franchise or whatever. Exorcist 3 is complete crap.
Yeah.
Sorry. Exorcist 2 is complete crap.
Two, yeah.
Exorcist 3 is, I think, one of the biggest sleepers of a horror movie that even a lot of horror fans don't give enough love to or know enough about. And so I highly recommend it. I saw it. Again, childhood has an influence. I saw it. It came out in 1990. I saw it on VHS at a friend's house not long after it came out on VHS. And so I was give or take around 10, 11 years old. And this is mostly a more cerebral horror movie than like a jump scare splatter guts sort of a movie. And you would think that, you know, younger kids aren't supposed to get more atmospheric and cerebral horror and that sort of thing. But this one got me. This one creeped me out, and I can remember it causing me some sleepless nights after I saw it for a while.
Outstanding. That's what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, maybe everyone's taste is subjective, but I think this is a excellent horror film that does not get enough respect.
Great. It sounds like we got some good picks with our, these might even be more interesting than our top five of all time, I think.
Yeah, a lot of those, with a few exceptions, a lot of those might be ones that people would have expected. But yeah, definitely these are, you know, more out of left field. And I'll just quickly run through my runners-up for this category as well. Phantasm, 1979, is a great, weird, atmospheric horror movie, one of those classics of late 70s, early 80s. Zodiac, directed by David Fincher, 2007, another one I love. The Gate, 1987, Stephen Dorff. The Ninth Gate, 1999, Roman Polanski, starring Johnny Depp, I think is very underrated. Event Horizon, 1997, is a sci-fi horror film starring Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne that I think is very underrated.
Yeah, that scared the crap out of me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's got a few flaws, but I think it's a very good horror film. Bone Tomahawk, 2015, starring Kurt Russell, is a Western horror film that I think is very good. Dead Heat, 1988. Dead Heat is a buddy cop sci-fi zombie horror comedy film starring Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo. Okay. So what the hell, how can you get any better than that? If you want like cheesy but still good 80s weird genre blending film, like Dead Heat, it's currently on Amazon Prime streaming, so go check that out. More recent one, The Babadook, 2014.
Yeah.
Matt Ravenous, 1999, which I reviewed on a Dangerous History podcast episode a while ago. The Thing also would be on my list there. And Mothman Prophecies, 2002.
Oh, with Richard Gere, yeah.
Yeah, I think that one is, and again, it's another one of these, it's slow, but in a good way. And it marinates its atmosphere, and it doesn't give you answers. And yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah.
So those are some of my runners up for that category.
All right. Outstanding.
Well, you didn't have any runners up for that category. You didn't compile a list on that one.
I did. I kind of mentioned some of them. The one that I would mention and that I it was on my top five, but for various reasons, I took it off the top five overlooked, is The Last Man on Earth from 1964. Which again is based on Richard Matheson's I Am Legend.
Oh yeah, that's the Vincent Price
one. Vincent Price one, which is I think it's public domain, so I think you could just like watch it on YouTube. It predates Night of the Living Dead, and if you watch it, you'll be like, "Oh, like so somebody was already thinking about this kind of stuff." Like it's Vincent Price, I think it's his best role in all those kind of golden age of horror movies that he was in. But yeah, I think that's my honorable mention. I really love it, and I try to watch it around Halloween if I can, especially since I can just typically log on to YouTube and watch it. Somebody's got it up.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's one I haven't watched in a while. I'll have to check that one out again.
Okay, so that is where we will leave it off for this episode. And the next episode, which will come out just within a day or two of this one probably, is going to be the second half of our conversation, where we switch from films to fiction. So, I will talk to you soon. You've enjoyed listening to the Dangerous History Podcast, and I hope that you found some value in it. If you have and you'd like to contribute to my work, there are many different ways that you can help out. One that costs you nothing but maybe a little bit of time and effort is to help spread the word about the show to anyone you think might be interested in it. There are also a bunch of ways that you can financially assist me to continue doing the work that I do and to continue making it better as best I can as time goes on. The most helpful way, and the one that gives you potentially a lot of value back in return, is to sign up for a recurring contribution via either Patreon or Subscribestar. And the links to my Patreon page and my Subscribestar page will be in the show notes of this episode. I now have multiple levels of support via either Patreon or Subscribestar. For $2 per month, you are at the Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, and you will get access to all of the vintage DHP episodes, meaning the first 52 episodes of the show, which are no longer available to the general public. And of course, you'll get the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping to keep this podcast going, and you'll have my gratitude for doing so. For only $5 per month, you will be at the Journeyman Scholar Warrior level. And for this, you'll receive the benefits of the $2 Apprentice Scholar Warrior level, plus access to special bonus DHP episodes that are available nowhere else, as well as access to ad-free regular DHP episodes as they come out, and you will be eligible to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. For $15 per month, you will be at the Scholar Warrior level, and you'll get all the benefits of the Journeyman level, plus access to Dangerous History Lyceum course lectures as they are produced and released. And for $25 per month, you'll be at the Master Scholar Warrior level, where you will get all the benefits of the $15 Scholar Warrior level, plus additional benefits, still to be determined, but probably including but not limited to a regular live chat. You can also make one-time or recurring contributions to the Dangerous History Podcast via PayPal or Bitcoin. And another great way you can help out my work is by clicking on any of the Amazon affiliate links on my website to do your Amazon.com shopping. And if you buy stuff after going through any of those affiliate links, I get a little commission at no additional cost to you. And this helps me to buy supplies, research materials, etc., to keep making the podcast and making the podcast better. I also have an Amazon wish list of things to help me out with the Dangerous History Podcast and related productions that I put in the show notes of episodes. It's mostly research materials, but also there's some stuff in there, hardware for audiovisual production, etc. So if you want to order me something off there, that also helps out. Your support and contributions are what keeps this thing going and keeps me doing the work that I do. So I hope that you will consider helping out. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast. As always, doing my best to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.